broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman live on your radio. Hard-hitting news that networks refuse to use, no doubt, starts now. This, my fellow Americans, is the broadcast for May 17th in the year of our Lord, 2021. This is hour one of two, and our goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, and to promote God, family, and country on your radio and the traditions of our founding fathers. Yes, indeed, we use the blueprint for liberty, the supreme law of the land, the Constitution for the United States of America as our guide. And absolutely, we're convinced the checks and balances brilliantly put in place by the founding fathers, one of the great peaceful restorative solutions we have at our fingertips. As you know, we reject revolution. We stand for peaceful restoration of the greatest country on the face of the earth. Wow, I had a fantastic weekend. Hope you did as well. Mine was full of God, family, and country, and full of the protection of life, liberty, and property. Let's see. Right after the show on Friday, I got ready and took off with Sheriff Richard Mack. And we drove to Battle Mountain, Nevada. Got all ready, geared up, spent the night, and had a fantastic Saturday. We kicked off Saturday by broadcasting live. It was me and Sheriff Richard Mack together on your radio from Battle Mountain. Sam and Mack broadcasting live from Battle Mountain, Lander County, Nevada. Now, Lander County is out in the boonies, but it's about 7,000 people, and they have become the first declared constitutional county in the country that I know of. They even took the time to register with the CSPOA as a constitutional county, and they wanted us to come and present a plaque, which we did. We both spoke. It was a rally today. That was Saturday. A celebration of liberty is what they're calling it. And it was at a place called Elquist Park. A very nice venue. Interesting thing is it rained on us a little bit. Very strange indeed with that, but we did very well nevertheless. I mean, there was literally, ladies and gentlemen, probably 1,200 people there. That would be my best guess. It's really hard to gauge because there was no registration of any kind. You just come. There's no tickets or anything like that. Just show up. So there's no way to gauge the crowd. We just had to look over it. I had about 20 different people look for me and give me their estimates. And how I'm gauging that is, I'm taking everybody's estimates, kind of dropping the high numbers and the low numbers and, you know, sticking with the people that guessed in the middle. A lot of people said 1,500. Some people even said 2,000. I don't think there were that many. Some people said 500, and then they go, probably more, but I don't know how many more kind of stuff. My best guess is around 1,200 from all the analyzing that I did. I had a couple of people that were accountants who knew how to kind of look at numbers and gauge. So Joe Bannister was with me. He's one of the guys that gave me an example, did a wonderful job. Joe basically looked around and did some calculations and came back and said, my best guess is 12 to 1500 people. And what he would do is he would count five or six clusters of people, see how many people were in the clusters. Then he'd basically, you know, say, okay, well, if that's five clusters, then what does this look like? Anyway, I don't know. Our best guess is the best I can say, but I'm telling you, there were more than 1,000 people there. Very confident in that reality check. So there you go. 1,200 people in an outside rally in the rain. Speaker after speaker after speaker. I mean, I'm telling you right now, we talked about on the radio too. We have a peaceful intent for this whole rally. And if it got violent or if Antifa or anybody showed up and there was conflict, we were going to leave. Our peaceful intent, if it gets violent, we're leaving. We claimed at the start. Ladies and gentlemen, there was zero. I'm going to say it again. There was zero violence, zero heckling, zero conflict. It was a day to remember. There was food trucks. There were speakers. There was patriotic music. There was Americans outdoors where it's safe. Spending time together, laughing and crying and praying and standing and arguing and, you know, discussing politics and, I mean, everything else. It was just a phenomenal time. And most importantly, though, we really articulated our goal to be peaceful. There were a lot of cops there. I talked to a lot of the different sheriffs that were there. They had a tremendous amount of security. But the security was incredible. It was good enough to show their presence, to say, hey, guys, we don't want any trouble. But it was also hands-off enough to let the people just enjoy themselves. I mean, it was phenomenal. It was a very well-done event. It was not costly to put on because it was just outside. There was a stage and speakers. I mean, it was just phenomenal. I got the chance to speak. A quick 30 seconds on my speech, I got up there and talked about, hey, you can't let the media bully you around, ladies and gentlemen. They've been lying and manipulating the truth about us and about everything else for so long. They've lost their credibility. You know what? The new media has taken center stage. He who owns the media makes the rules. It is up to you, my fellow Americans, to make sure that you challenge the media when they're dishonest. And that was the point of my speech. I said, look, you have got to challenge the media whenever they're wrong. Don't be rude. Don't be belligerent. Don't be crazy. But insist. Say, you know what? That's just not the truth. And so I talked about that. I also talked about critical race theory a little bit, how bogus it is. The general summation of critical race theory is that if you're white, you're a racist. There's no way to prevent it. It's so systemic, you don't even know that it's happening. But you're a racist, and there's no way to prevent it if you're white. If you're not white, then you are never a racist. You can't be a racist. You're a flat-out victim, and that's all there is to it. That's what critical race theory teaches. I blew that narrative out of the water with a little story that I told in my talk. And I said, you know, I'm a totally blind person, as many of you may or may not know. And I went to my door one time because somebody knocked on it, and I opened the door, and a guy was trying to sell me something. And I was not too interested in what he had to sell, and I was standing there talking to him, just going, look, I'm not really that interested. Da-da-da. And the guy's like, oh, come on, sir, you can, you know, learn about this, and you can do that. And I said, no, I'm really not. And my daughter walks up, and she says, Dad, he's trying to shake your hand. Well, I didn't know because I'm a totally blind person. He had his hand out. So I reached out my hand, and the second I reached out my hand to shake his hand, because now, you know, I'm blind, but my daughter told me that he had his hand out, so I'm going to shake his hand, right? I didn't realize where I would have put out my hand before. But then he yanks his hand back. He goes, no, sir. It doesn't rub off. It don't rub off. And I'm like, what? Well, it turns out the guy was black. And the guy put his hand out, wanted me to shake his hand, which I would have done. But then when I finally understood, because my daughter told me he had his hand out, Dad, shake his hand. He's got his hand out for you. Then I tried to, and he basically put his hand back, and he goes, look, it doesn't rub off. I know, just because of who I am, you don't have to shake my hand. It's all right, sir. Then he started backing away from the door and got all kind of rude. And then I said, sir, I'm a totally blind person. You don't have to make excuses, sir. It's okay. I understand. People like you in your neighborhood don't want to deal with people like me. He went on like this. And at the end of that little story that I told, I said, now I got a question for you. Who's the racist? This guy's got such a chip on his shoulder that I'm the white guy and I live in the nice hood and whatever I do, and that I'm, you know, not willing to shake his hand because he's black or whatever else. I'm not the racist. I didn't know he had his hand out. Anyway, the story, I think, went over well to help people understand the critical race theory is a lie. And so I finished by saying, you know what? We're all God's children. And we need to behave like it. And then I finally finished by saying, God bless. And then I said, you know what? God save the Republic. And that's what we need today, that's for sure. We also talked about me and Richard Mack during the show that we have evidence the FBI had an ever presence at the event. And my message to the FBI is you're more than welcome to be here, but I want you to obey the law as well. All government bureaucrats need to obey the law too, including you, FBI. Don't get any crazy ideas. Don't stir anybody up. And don't investigate all of us for just being normal Americans expressing our First Amendment rights. We also talked about the outdoor bus tour. Yeah, we talked about Richard Mack getting an FBI raid back in the day when he ran for sheriff of the state of Utah. We talked about Biden's win sees higher prices, increased taxes, and more. We talked about getting back to fundamental principles that we can all agree upon, or at least we should. That is the supreme law of the land, the Constitution. We talked about let freedom ring across America. And let freedom be proclaimed across the land. No exemptions to liberty is the point. Anyway, we had a great time. I'm going to talk more about this bus tour. Let me just give you a 2 second on it now, and we'll drill into it more later. The bus tour is done by Robert David Steele. And it's called the Rise USA, the Resurrection Tour. Robert David Steele. And the cool part about this bus tour is that the whole bus tour, which is going to be going on from now till 2024, where buses are crisscrossing the country, and they're having spontaneous rallies wherever they go. Well, the kickoff of that was in Lander County 2 days ago on Saturday. I was there live for the kickoff. There were two buses there. and they were wrapped buses. And one of the wrapped buses is wrapped as a constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, CSPOA.org, wrapped bus. I'm telling you, it is cool, baby. It is all right. So Robert Steele came out and talked or spoke. Richard Mack spoke. I spoke. I'm telling you, it was a wonderful time had by all. Just phenomenal people doing phenomenal things. Lots of people from all over the country were there for the kickoff of the bus tour in conjunction with the first county in the United States to declare themselves publicly a constitutional county. Man, I don't know that it gets better than that. There's a wrap of Saturday's broadcast and what I did all weekend. News the networks refused to use today starts now. Lowell Nelson, campaignforliberty.org, RonPaulInstitute.org with me. And you had a fantastic weekend, too, from what I understand, sir.
Sure did, Sam. You had invited me to join you there on Saturday, but I had a prior commitment to visit the Front Sight Firearms Institute there near Pahrump, Nevada. Now, lots of people maybe not have not heard of this place, but it is amazing resort.
And when we get back, you'll tell us all about it, ladies and gentlemen. Lowell Nelson with us. Two phenomenal things going on the last weekend. I'm sure there's way more with some of the wonderful things that you people were doing as well. Hang tight. Liberty Roundtable Live with Lowell Nelson on your radio.
Why don't we say to the government writ large that they have to spend a little bit less? Anybody ever had less money this year than you had last? Anybody ever having a 1% pay cut? You deal with it. That's what government needs, a 1% pay cut. If you take a 1% pay cut across the board, you have more than enough money to actually pay for the disaster relief. But nobody's going to do that because they're fiscally irresponsible. Who are they? Republicans. Who are they? Democrats. Who are they? Virtually the whole body is careless and reckless with your money. So the money will not be offset by cuts anywhere. The money will be added to the debt, and there will be a day of reckoning. What's the day of reckoning? The day of reckoning may well be the collapse of the stock market. The day of reckoning may be the collapse of the dollar. When it comes, I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you it has happened repeatedly in history when countries ruin their currency.
You know where the solution can be found, Mr. President? In churches, in wedding chapels, in maternity wards across the country and around the world. More babies will mean forward-looking adults, the sort we need to tackle long-term, large-scale problems. American babies in particular are likely going to be wealthier, better educated, and more conservation-minded than children raised in still industrializing countries. As economist Tyler Cowen recently wrote, quote, "By having more children, you're making your nation more populous, thus boosting its capacity to solve climate change. The planet does not need for us to think globally and act locally so much as it needs us to think family and act personally. The solution to so many of our problems, at all times and in all places, is to fall in love, get married, and have some kids."
All right, back with you live, ladies and gentlemen. While I was at the kickoff bus tour, the first county in America to announce their public constitutional county status, hope they truly stick with that, Lowell Nelson was hanging out at Front Sight, learning about the right to keep and bear arms and how to safely use those arms for all kinds of reasons. Lowell?
Well, thank you, Sam. As you may know, the mission of the Institute is to restore the Second Amendment in our lifetime. Wouldn't it be great to turn back the clock where everybody has a gun, everybody has a weapon, and carries it around with them? I mean, that would be an awesome thing. Anyway, the Institute offers dozens and dozens of courses. These courses are centered around handguns, rifles, and shotguns that also offers self-defense martial arts training, and this I didn't know, self-defense knife training. Very interesting. Now, the course that we chose, there were five of us, actually, four from northern Utah and one from southern Utah. So five of us, we chose a shotgun skill builder course. Now, I had never been trained on a shotgun. I think I'd shot a shotgun once or twice, shot some skeet for fun at some camp somewhere, but I really didn't know much about shotguns. And those who are familiar with shotguns, those of you who are listening, are really going to laugh out loud at my next comment. But everyone knows that a shotgun is used to shoot a bird out of the air. But did you know, Sam, that a shotgun can also fire a slug?
Actually, I did know that.
I did not know that. I can't believe it, where I've been all these years. But, yeah, shotguns can also fire slugs. So we bought and trained with birdshot, buckshot, and with slugs. We learned about the tool itself, the shotgun, how it operates and how to operate it safely, effectively, and efficiently. We practiced shooting the various types of ammunition. We practiced shooting from various platforms, standing, kneeling, prone. We learned how a shotgun can malfunction and how to fix each malfunction quickly. And we learned how to shoot a slug quickly, even though the shotgun was already loaded with birdshot or with buckshot. And we talked about this various scenarios about why we would want to do that. This was a two-day course, it was Friday and Saturday of last week. We learned how the shotgun is probably one of the most versatile defensive firearms for the home. And at least, some people really strongly feel it's the best weapon of choice, for home defense. Turns out that there's an instructor at Front Sight, at least one of them, there's probably many, who has a shotgun in nearly every room in his home in a biometric safe. So he just presses his thumb or finger or toe up against this biometric safe. It opens and out comes his shotgun. That house can be well defended, if you've got that kind of firepower in every room. Cause I guess you never know when you're going to need it. You don't know what room of the house you're going to be in when, a burglar attacks your house or, some gang member tries to come into your house. So this particular instructor is going to be well prepared. So we had a great time, Sam. The sun was hot. Yes. The air was dry. Very true. And the wind picked up, whistled from time to time, especially on Saturday afternoon while we were testing our skills. But it was absolutely invigorating and worthwhile. I come back from these trips to Front Sight so excited, so energetic, so enthused about what we learned there that, we're already planning our next trip to Front Sight sometime next fall. So that's a recap of my weekend, Sam. I'm glad you had a good time, and I'm just telling you, I had a great time as well.
And ladies and gentlemen, Front Sight, if you really talk to the right people, there's a lot of people out there who have become lifetime members and stuff like that, who have really, really good opportunities and deals on Front Sight, by the way.
That's right. In fact, we have a pack right here in the state of Utah, Sam, called the Platform Republicans Pack, where members of the pack who donate, $100 to the pack, or if they want to donate $10 a month to the pack, we will award them a free class at Front Sight. And these classes are valued at $1,000. It's a two-day defensive handgun class, which you can pick up for merely a $100 donation to the pack. So you, not only do you support a pack that's doing good work in the state of Utah, we basically helped to elect Republicans to the legislature who will defend the platform and adhere to the platform. And so not only can you support the pack, but you get this free class at Front Sight and become trained on the use of a handgun for home defense and self-defense. Sam?
All right. Anyway, Front Sight Firearms Institute does a phenomenal job. I don't get a penny to promote them, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just telling you, their skill builder classes are incredible. And, it is important to have guns, to understand your God-given inalienable right of self-defense, codified in the Constitution as the Second Amendment to the Bill of Rights, saying, hey, you know what? You have a right to keep and bear arms, and that right shall not be infringed. So we defend that right big time. But we also submit to you that it's important to get appropriate training. It's important to learn about those things. You know, if you want to fly a plane, you got to have good training. If you want to, you know, it's not saying that you don't have a right to these things, but it is saying let's be responsible with them. And Lowell taking this all the way to the mat. How do you like that, ladies and gentlemen? All right, the police should sometimes avert their eyes. Walter E. Block with an incredible column to discuss that I think is really worthy of discussion here, Lowell.
Yes, Walter Block thinks outside the box, and he wrote a column that was posted at the RonPaulInstitute.org last Monday, May 10th, and he describes the impact of this, you know, defund the police movement that swept the country last summer and, you know, seems to be sticking in some of the counties. Numerous members of our police forces have been trashed. Their reputations are trashed. Their profession gets trashed, you know, by these defund the police types. He said it's now more difficult to attract people to the profession. Numerous retirements have occurred, and the quit rate is high. And so basically he stated that's the problem, and then he said, now what could they do to repair the situation? What can we do? I mean, we need police to protect the vulnerable ones in society, right? So how can we solve this problem, this hemorrhaging of personnel from police forces? And so he came up with a very interesting solution, and it's one that can be implemented immediately. He writes this. He says, quote, it is simple. Avert their eyes from victimless crime. Become libertarians. This is the philosophy predicated upon the non-aggression principle, private property rights, and free association, end quote. Now, put another way, it's the philosophy that you don't hurt people and you don't take their stuff. That's basic libertarianism, and it's not capital L libertarian, it's small l libertarianism, okay? So police are still needed to enforce laws that prohibit real crimes like murder and rape and theft, and kidnapping, carjacking, fraud, and so on. The list is endless there. But those are real crimes. They're not fiat crimes. You know, a fiat crime is like fiat money. The government telling you that piece of paper there is worth something. It's not really worth anything, but they tell you that it's worth something. So a fiat crime is, in my opinion, an action made illegal by government edict. This is not Walter Block talking. This is Lowell Nelson talking about fiat crime.
But let's
crime.
Also add to your point, Lowell, about fiat crimes, because it be clear. Not only is fiat crime a bogus crime because there's no crime maybe committed, but it's a selective enforcement scenario as well. In other words, the government can make money, but you can't. The government can do this, but you can't. The government can steal my money to put kids in government schools, but hey, I can't take money from anybody else, so that would be theft, kind of an idea. Okay, this is where government gets special privilege beyond the authority of the consent of the governed, where they just literally seize power. It's fiat, it's fake, it's dishonest, it's immoral, okay? And it creates victims everywhere. So fiat crimes oftentimes are not victimless. They have plenty of victims. They're fiat in the sense that power has been seized under a supposed authority. It's called pretend legislation. Go ahead, Lowell.
And yeah, and it goes back to the idea that if you have this moral authority to do something, then government does as well, because government derives its just power from the people. But if you don't have the moral authority to do something, like walk across the street and take money from your neighbor in order to educate your own children, then neither does government have that authority. If the people don't have the authority, then government cannot have that authority. So Block then gives several examples. Breonna Taylor, she was shot in a drug bust, but under libertarianism, all drugs would be legal. If the cops operated under the libertarian legal code, they would have refused to honor the order to arrest anyone for such a crime.
Let's talk a little more about this with Lowell Nelson, because I'm not a libertarian in the party sort of the word, and I'm not 100% libertarian in my views, but we all can have a little bit more libertarian viewpoints along the way. I'm called a libertarian with morals. How do you like that? All right, hang tight. Lowell Nelson in seconds.
Your daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
U.S. USA Radio News with Lance Pry.
At least two people were killed, including a 12-year-old boy, and more than 150 others hurt in the West Bank on Sunday when a bleacher collapsed during a packed holiday prayer service at a Jewish synagogue. The ultra-Orthodox House of Worship was still under construction, and the Israeli Fire and Rescue Service says building owners did not have a permit to support the large number of people. Staying in the region, Israeli warplanes continued a series of heavy airstrikes at several locations of Gaza City early Monday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the fourth war with Gaza's Hamas rulers would continue on. Hamas also continued to attack, launching rockets from civilian areas in Gaza towards civilian areas in Israel. NASA has successfully launched a Black Brant 12 rocket from its Wallops flight facility in Virginia Sunday night. The project is designed to study how energy and momentum are transported between different regions of space that are magnetically connected. USA Radio News.
Recently, President Trump was talking about the big news networks, and here's what he said.
We have others that come along, and they're doing well, and Newsmax has been really good, and, you know, others are coming along.
Many Americans agree. Newsmax TV is really good. Nielsen says more than 30 million Americans watch Newsmax. You should, too. And find hit shows with Greg Kelly, Grant Stinchfield, Sean Spicer, and Lindsay Keith. Tune in tonight for Newsmax's newest show with Steve Cortez. It's called Cortez and Pellegrino. Newsmax is on all major cable systems. If you don't get it, call your cable system. Tell them you want Newsmax, or you can switch. Plus, get Newsmax free on most smart TVs and OTT devices like Roku, Pluto, Zumo, and Amazon Fire. Millions have already downloaded the free Newsmax app on their smartphones. So start watching America's fastest-growing cable news channel. Because Newsmax is real news for real people.
An unnamed man believed to be responsible for two early morning murders at Brother Bryan Park in Birmingham, Alabama, opened fire on four police officers Sunday afternoon, striking all officers. Birmingham police spokesman Rod Malden.
Two were struck by gunfire, which their injuries appear to be non-life-threatening at the time. They're expected to make a full recovery.
Police believe the shooting began over a dog. The assailant was fatally shot by officers during the incident.
When officers arrived, they discovered a female laying in the middle of the roadway, suffering from an apparent gunshot wound. She was rushed to the hospital, where she was later pronounced deceased. We also had an adult male at that location that was found unresponsive on the sidewalk. He was pronounced deceased on the scene.
A brush fire in Topanga Canyon, California, gained strength Sunday as about 1,000 residents remain under mandatory evacuation orders. L.A. Fire Department says the dense vegetation is very dry and has not burned in 50-plus years. USA Radio News.
All right, live and on your radio, Lowell Nelson, campaignforliberty.org with me. We were mentioning right before the pause this libertarian idea. I'm not a libertarian in the sense of, I'm not a libertarian as in terms of a party member. And, you know, the problem with libertarianism a little bit is that it depends on how far you embrace the ideas of less to no government. You know, I asked one guy who was a hardcore libertarian, his name is Ernest Hancock, what's the difference between a libertarian and an anarchist? He said, oh, but a couple of election cycles. So, you know, you got to be a little bit careful with libertarian ideas in the sense that they can go too far. Some libertarians are for prostitution, saying, hey, you can do whatever you want. I say there's a moral component to society where if you do certain things and or promote certain things or don't oppose certain things, society becomes immoral in a hurry. And that's why we're not, you know, we're a constitutional republic, not a libertarian complete bastion. Although I agree with some libertarian principles in that we need less government. We need less hands-on. We need less control. People need to be left to their agency to a great degree. Anyway, we're talking about police should sometimes avert their eyes, which is a libertarian kind of an idea. Walter E. Block with the idea saying it's simple, just avert their eyes from victimless crimes. Become libertarian, if you will. This is the philosophy predicated on don't hurt me, don't take my stuff kind of an idea. Now, I agree with the general premise here, though, and I think he's on to something for sure, Lowell.
Yeah, I'm like you, Sam. I want the Constitution. I think it's a divinely inspired document, and it constrains the general government to specific performance, And it gives to states, and of course the states that wrote the Constitution, it reserves to them, in a plenary way, all other, you know, rights and authority. And, you know, it reserves to those states and to the people, all other rights. And so within that framework, I am a strong proponent of don't hurt people and don't take their stuff. But like you, I agree there needs to be responsibility for the exercise of freedom and liberty. And if individuals fail to be responsible in their exercise of their liberty, then they will lose their liberty. And so there are consequences to our actions. We need to be very, very careful about what we do and what we don't do. So Walter E. Block, I think, has hit upon an idea that would help police forces immediately. I mean, today. They could implement policies where, I mean, they could, you know, if they get an order to raid somebody's home at 5 a.m. with a SWAT team, and the charge is that this person is smoking pot, they could, you know, be found doing other things. They could simply ignore that particular order and have more important things to do, like investigating a murder or investigating a theft or a rape or something that has real impact, substantive impact on a person's individual rights. Whereas, you know, smoking pot, even though, you know, we may not like that, it's not nearly as serious, and it's a victimless crime unless that pot smoker goes and hurts somebody. So it's just very interesting that this idea that police could immediately activate this idea and their reputation would come back up, I think. I think if people understood that the police were prosecuting real criminals instead of these fiat crimes, that they would have a newfound respect for the police, and the police wouldn't lose their personnel as quickly. The quit rate would go down, and it would become a noble profession once again. So anyway, that's the idea. Block, he understands that the criticisms of the police might never entirely disappear, but he believes it would mostly evaporate if police fought real crimes, not fiat crimes. Sam?
I agree with him in general, and I agree they need to avert their eyes on one hand. On the other hand, I find them not averting their eyes when it comes to crimes that have no victim. What they do is they go after it like they have to enforce all laws. However, when it's a special person, a celebrity, a politician, someone, then they seem to avert their eyes in certain cases, this selective enforcement idea. I have a problem with that kind of a mentality, but I also have a problem with averting their eyes when there is a victim. I'll give you an example. Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and some of these groups have been beating people up, the Proud Boys, etc., and I don't care which side of the aisle they come from. You know what? And they've been hurting people, and the government has turned a blind eye to that. They've just kind of looked at it, and cops have been just like, not going to touch that. Or when they see rioting and insurrections and abuses and destruction of property, and okay, those are victim-related crimes. Okay, if my property's harmed, I'm a victim. If I'm physically assaulted, I'm a victim. They've been ignoring those crimes, but yet victimless crimes they've been going after with a fervor. And so not only do I agree with him on this point, but I also agree we need to start to say, hey, why aren't they prosecuting these crimes with victims? When you have private property destroyed all over Seattle, and when you have individuals being beat up all across the country, and we see more and more evidence that when Antifa and Black Lives Matter beat people up, the cops not only turn a blind eye to it, but they oftentimes go after the victim. And we've seen this from all the way local cops all the way to the FBI, and they've even admitted it publicly that this is happening in many news sources now. Okay, this stuff has got to stop. So the selective enforcement, the protecting of certain groups is a real problem, probably even a bigger problem in many cases than just this victimless crime discussion. I wanted to finish up on that because I think there's a lot here that really creates anger and hate between the cops and the people. We've got to work on solving this or we're in trouble in America.
That's right. Just one other example. Last year when the police went out and arrested the housewife, a mother of children, for playing in the playground, right? I mean, it was in the outside, and they were playing in the playground, and the police came along and said, this park is off limits. We'll arrest you if you don't leave. I mean, that is searching for victimless criminals right there. I mean, these people out playing in the park were not hurting anybody. They were enjoying themselves, and the police come along and arrest. you know, order them off for trespassing and then arrest for trespassing if they don't leave. That is the cause of, you know, the people disrespecting police. And so if they would stop doing that type of thing, then our respect for the police could rise back up and amount to something, Sam.
There you have it. All right, two important topics down, a couple to go. Prior to 1913, ladies and gentlemen, no one paid income tax. Why? And why do they pay now? Very critical topic, Lowell.
Well, and I thought it was a timely topic because this is tax day. This is the day, May 17th, 2021, when individuals across the country are supposed to file their tax returns. It's the last day. It's the deadline day. Basically, a lot of people will file in January, late January, because they want to get the money back that the government took from them. Of course, I wait until the last day because I usually pay a little money in. And I finished preparing my tax returns yesterday, and so this topic is really fresh on my mind. The Constitution is now well over 230 years old, Sam. But do you know, do people know, do our listeners realize that we had no federal income tax for the first 124 years of this Constitution? And the general government handled its expenses just fine, right? So for 124 years, this country worked just fine without the federal income tax. And, of course, most states piggyback their income taxes on top of the federal. So really, we didn't have state income taxes until then either. So how in the world did the government, the general government, exist? How did it operate without these federal income taxes? Well, the answer is tariffs and excises. Basically, a tariff is a fee on an import. An excise is a fee on a domestically made manufactured product. And it turns out that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, Harry Brown observed that tariffs and excise taxes are self-limited taxes. Now, this, Sam, I want you to comment on this in a second here. I had never heard this concept about a self-limited tax. But what he observed was that if a tax was raised too high, then the product gets priced out of the reach of the consumer, so sales go down, and tax revenues also fall because that product is not being purchased anymore. These self-limiting taxes stand in stark contrast to the income tax, because as income tax rates rise, they can be increased forever, basically go up forever, since most people cannot choose to stop working in order to avoid the tax. And that is not a self-limited tax. In other words, now, Sam, that's a concept Harry Brown articulated 20 or 30 years ago. I've never read that concept. What do you think about this idea of a self-limited tax?
All right, I think the concept is absolutely brilliant to understand. And I think the Founding Fathers had kind of a sliding scale of acceptability when it comes to taxes. So right now, you say prior to 1913, no one paid income tax. Why and why now? And then your second headline related to this says this: the founder's view versus the progressive income tax. When we come back, I want to talk more about that in detail because I think that Lowell Nelson's on to something here. Well, I want to build your understanding of the Founding Fathers' view. It wasn't a simple to tax or not to tax. It was a how can we generate the limited monies for the proper role of government, no more, no less. How do we make sure that it doesn't abuse the people in the process? All these realities in the mix. We'll talk about them in seconds on your radio.
Have we realized the assault against our lives, our liberties, our faith? To defeat this assault, Christians and all people of goodwill should have strategies to prevail in our faith and principles, which are simple. No need for a complex formula. One goal, one aim. A strategy like the heroic Christians of the past. We win, they lose. Nothing less. Big Q, Little Q. The Calm Before the Storm by a friend of Medjugorje. The strategy of heaven revealed. Big Q, Little Q. The Calm Before the Storm, available on Amazon.com or by calling Caritas in the U.S. at 205-672-2000.
Foundation for Moral Law is a nonprofit legal foundation committed to protecting our unalienable right to publicly acknowledge God. The Foundation for Moral Law exists to restore the knowledge of God in law and government and to acknowledge and defend the truth that man is endowed with rights not by our fellow man, but by God. The foundation maintains a twofold focus. First, litigation within state and federal courts. Second, education, conducting seminars to teach the necessity and importance of acknowledging God in law and government. How can you help? Please make a tax-deductible contribution, allowing foundation attorneys to continue the fight. You may also purchase various foundation products as well at morallaw.org. Located in Montgomery, Alabama, the Foundation for Moral Law is a nonprofit, tax-exempt 501c3, founded by Judge Roy Moore. Please partner with us to achieve this important mission. morallaw.org.
All right, we're talking about taxes. The founder's view versus the progressive income tax. Really, the founder's view versus modern day is the real discussion. And Lowell Nelson said, prior to 1913, no one paid income tax. Why? And why do we pay now? It's a great question. And what about this self-limiting tax discussion? And you know, the founders debated this stuff publicly. It was in the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. It was in their debates all over the place, and they had several different, bullet points to the debates. One of them was this indirect versus direct taxation. And the founders were insistent that the taxes were not direct because they said, look, direct taxation can get too involved in your personal life. It could just, finding out how much money you make, all these details about who you are, your personal information. They knew about privacy and they knew about anonymity. Because King George would take names and, pardon the pun, kick butts. I mean, he would literally, and so they met in secret. They would meet in quiet and they would, plan it because they were afraid of the abuses by name. They wrote under pseudonyms back in the day for this reason as well, et cetera, et cetera. Well, anyway, so the direct versus indirect debate was one of them. The more a tax was direct, the more unconstitutional it was viewed to be. The more indirect it was, the more legitimate it might be to raise money. But this also question that you brought up about a self-limiting tax is critical and vital. The second part of the debate or the discussion economically was, hey, should I tax the income side or the expenditure side of your taxes? And the real answer constitutionally is, well, let's get away from that whole process the best we can and not be in that process. But the idea is if you tax my income, you tax my ability to earn. Then you encourage me to not want to earn as much as I can. You literally shut down that spigot, that flow of water, if you will, finances, right from the source, which is dangerous. Because if you manipulate me into a corner, I'm just going to say, well, I'm only going to work to a certain amount, and then I'm not going to work anymore because I don't want to be taxed so hard. It's so abusive. It's grievous to be born. I'm not going to tolerate it. On the other hand, if you tax the expenditure side, then you give me a little bit of a buffer. I can earn and not spend and thus improve my wealth still. Etc. So taxing on the spend side of the equation is much better than the income side of the equation, but it's still far from perfect because it's still too direct in many ways. Okay, when I go in and pay a sales tax, at least I don't have to give my name. But yet it really creates a choke point, meaning the businesses now are responsible to collect and to monitor and to charge and to assess and to do all these things. They've just changed who the monitoring is, right? And I agree that it's better in a general sense on a business in a generic way than maybe on a person individualistically speaking. So sales tax is better than income tax. But the debate really came down to from the founding fathers is, hey, let's make it as indirect as possible and let's not really attack that economic equation. Let's have two kinds of taxes, an apportionment tax, which simply says, Sam, in Utah, you're one of 3 million Americans. Therefore, Utah-wise, you have 1/3 millionth. And on a federal government level, Sam, there's 330 million people. You're one of 330 millionth, if you will. And therefore, we can figure out what the cost of legitimate government budget expenditures are. And you know what, Sam? You can pay your fair share. And then the states can assess. Then upon good behavior, they can send that money to the federal government if the federal government behaves properly. That's apportionment tax. The other tax is a tariff at the border tax, which says, you know, we got to charge the sales side of the equation somehow, but let's make it as indirect as we can. Let's not have our businesses being monitored. Let's not have a day-to-day interactions for Americans to be bugged by it. But when you bring product in from other nations, let's have a small tariff. That'll pay for the proper government. It will not put it on the backs of the American people. Let's make sure that it's small so it doesn't manipulate the level playing field that's out there. And let's make sure that it's as indirect as it can be, and let's make sure that it's as small as it can be. And so the real founding fathers debate came finally down to, let's have as indirect taxation as we could possibly get. Let's not attack the economic side so we have this situation. If we're going to any degree, let's make it a self-limiting tax. Meaning that, hey, if you put too much tariff on the border, the people in America are going to be frustrated because they have to pay too much for their goods. If it's too low, then, hey, Americans won't become have enough competition. Let's balance all that in the free market and see where it all lands. And they did this with apportionment taxes and tariffs at the border taxation in an effort to try to make taxes out of the way, out of sight, out of mind, but very small indeed, but literally cover the proper role of government. That was the intent of the founders, and that's a summation, probably a little longer than you wanted, Lowell, but that's a summation of the real economic debate, the tax debate, the need for legitimate taxes, but the very serious concern that, hey, it would become too direct and too onerous, too progressive, too abusive, too communistic, and they did all they could to prevent it, and we failed them, sir.
Wow, that's a wonderful summary, Sam. I like that very much. And it turns out that the current government, the general government, has violated this this notion of the founders on at least two fronts. Number one, they've made taxes direct with the implementation of the 13th Amendment in 1913, and then they've also been printing money out of thin air, which was also prohibited by the Constitution. They said, in other words, if they can print money out of thin air, they really don't need to tax. So the tax, the income tax, is really for show. It's political theater, since they have the ability to print money out of thin air. And so even if we were to get rid of the income tax entirely, if we still allowed the federal government to print money out of thin air, we'd still be in a pickle. They would still spend money making themselves too big with more reach than ever before. And so that alone is not the solution. But see, they have both. They not only do they have taxing authority directly on Americans, but they also have spending power because they can print money out of thin air. Now, should they be doing that? No. But are they doing it? Yes. And so that's a sort of a double whammy there. But you're absolutely right, Sam, about the use of taxation was carefully guarded. You know, by the founders. Madison in Federalist No. 10 said, the apportionment of taxes on the various descriptions of property is an act which seems to require the most exact impartiality. You know, you're talking about how important it is that impost excises be uniform throughout the United States. They wrote that right into the Constitution. So to be uniform, you can't tax one person at one rate and another person at a different rate. That's not a uniform tax. Now, have we had income taxes before 1913? Yes, there's two occasions. One was during the War of Northern Aggression, commonly known as the Civil War. A progressive income tax was enacted. It had a maximum tax rate of 10%, and it was repealed 10 years later in 1872. Then, Congress passed an income tax in 1894, one that hit only the top 2% of incomes, but the Supreme Court struck it down as unconstitutional. In fact, Justice Stephen Field, who had been sitting on the court for 30 years, was outraged that Congress would pass a bill to tax a small voting bloc and exempt the larger group of voters. At age 77, Field not only repudiated Congress's action, but he also penned a prophecy. He said that he predicted that this will be but a stepping stone. I mean, if a progressive tax were enacted, he said that would be a stepping stone to other larger, more sweeping taxes till our political contest would become a war of the poor against the rich.
And boy, howdy, do we see the reality of that coming true, huh, sir?
Absolutely came true, that one there. That's what we have today, you know, class warfare, where the poor are warfaring against the rich. How are they doing that, you might ask? Well, they do it by subscribing to welfare programs like food stamp programs and so forth, like welfare payments. Basically, you tax the productive classes and you give that money to the unproductive classes of people. Now, I am not against charity, but I am opposed to when the government steals money from you and me and gives it to people they want to give it to. That is not charity. That is theft. And some people call it government charity, but that's simply theft. And I'm opposed to that, but if we had more money in our pockets, then we would be more willing to donate to charitable causes. I mean, Sam, one of the questions I have for you is, what would you do with that extra, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 that today you have to pay to the general government, to the IRS? I mean, what would you do with that extra money?
I would employ people and put more money to charity. Are the two things that I would do, and I would say charity because I believe that I'm a minister to the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm his hands, his eyes, and his ears, and so I'd do more charitable things, and I'd also hire more people in my businesses. That's what I personally would do.
Yeah, and look at the impact I would have on the economy. You wouldn't be alone in that. There would be thousands of people who, like you, would have a little bit more money to put to charity, a little bit more money to employ people in their businesses, and it would be a real, you know, shot in the arm, so to speak, of productivity and prosperity and peace, because we wouldn't have this class warfare going on. We'd be more peaceful. We'd like our neighbors more because they wouldn't be stealing from us, and so we'd be more willing to dole money out to them if they truly needed help. And that's where charity ought to come from anyway, is our own neighbors. How can the government, how can Washington, D.C. know whether you really need the money or not? Well, they can't. How can a state government know? Well, they really can't. But your neighbors know. They know you. They know your situation. And you know the situation your neighbors live in. You are in a much, much better position to determine whether or not somebody needs help monetarily, you know, fiscal help, than any government entity can. It just makes sense, Sam. And so,
well, and they're
anyway,
going to need a lot less help if the government doesn't take a huge slice of the pie, too. Let's be clear.
That's right. I mean, for every dollar that goes back to Washington, D.C., you know, states get about 20 cents back, you know, and that may be an optimistic estimation right there. But, right, yeah, and so I'm really excited about the idea. I would love to see this idea come to pass, this idea where a state takes the revenues which normally would go to the general government. They take those revenues from the people, and then they only give to the general government, you know, the revenues if, you know, on good behavior. But until they are in good behavior, then the state spends that money in the state where it would otherwise be spent, right? So like for education. Now, this is not the ideal I'm talking, but a very pragmatic approach to the problem where they spend the money on education that would have come from the general government back to the state. Well, the state will just keep that there and not send it around through Washington, D.C., and would therefore have five times as much money to spend on education. So anyway, just a thought.
And local control without strings attached from some faraway Fed that has some agenda that may be contrary to the state and to the people as well. That's critical to know. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're concerned about this discussion on taxes, I propose that you put the Constitution for the United States of America on one side, and you put the Communist Manifesto on the other side, and then you read the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist papers and study the debate of the Founding Fathers on taxes. And I just hope you land on the Constitution side of the equation, ladies and gentlemen, because we've literally embraced the Communist Manifesto far more than I ever thought possible, and it is scary. Ladies and gentlemen, reject the godless communist agenda. Turn to God, family, and country via the supreme law of the land, the Constitution, inspired of Almighty God. It ought to be the political religion of our nation. I submit to you that we the people can make that happen if we educate ourselves and stand together in our sacred cause. Lowell, thank you so much, my brother.
You're welcome, Sam.
There he goes, campaignforliberty.org, doing a phenomenal job as always. Hour one in the can, hour two coming up. The good Dr. Scott Bradley with me, second hour. But for now, for Simon Lowell, we declare this nation shall endure. God save the Republic of the United States of America. Lovingliberty.net for live and on-demand radio.